Yusuf Islam, the British folk singer, once known as Cat Stevens, has accepted libel damages and a mea culpa from tabloid news service World Entertainment News Network for a report in March 2007 that said the Muslim singer reportedly had ignored female guides at a German awards ceremony because they weren't wearing veils. Islam's lawyer said the report had created an utterly false impression of his attitude to women and cast serious aspersions, quite wrongly, on his religious faith. The former Cat Stevens libel suit settled in July is just the latest in an ongoing parade of libel suits that hit the news. How much can someone say in print about you without fear that you can retaliate with a libel suit? How much can you say about a public person or a place? And in a libel suit, how important is the truth? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
How much can you get away with when you say something about a public figure, and for that matter, who qualifies as a public figure? How important is malice in a libel suit? Does libel law really get plaintiffs what they want? With its international reach, what effect has the Internet had on libel? Our guest is Robert Drexel, a professor with the School of Journalism and Mass Communications at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I'll try not to insult you so I don't get stuck with a libel suit.
Yeah, that's right. Watch what you say.
Well, let's start with a definition of terms, since we've all heard libel, slander, defamation, character assassination. What exactly is libel?
Well, it's defamation. That is, it's any kind of a statement that makes somebody look bad and would make other people likely to think less of that person.
Does it have to be a somebody?
It doesn't have to be a somebody. It can be a company.
A product.
An organization. It can even be a product, although there's technically a distinction made in the law between, you know, regular libel suits and product libel, trade libel, that sort of thing.
And so for it to be slander then as opposed to libel?
Well, usually the distinction is that libel is written and slander is spoken, but that distinction for the most part has disappeared. Certainly in a media context, it's disappeared.
What's the background of libel law? Does it come out of these personal attacks or something else?
It goes back centuries, at least our libel law does, into British law. And the roots, most people say the roots of libel law were in a desire by the state to stop people from taking the law into their own hands so that we could get away from a situation where if you insulted me, the solution was for me to track you down and beat you to a pulp or whatever the case might be. And so presumably that's how the courts began to take an interest and government began to take an interest in libel in the sense that we think of it now. But there was another form in which a government began to take an interest in libel, and that was when it came to libels of government itself and libels of public officials. In England, a speech was long controlled by a formal censorship mechanism, but that began to break down and become less and less effective and was ultimately abandoned by the British. And then was replaced by what turned out to be a much more effective tool, and that was not trying to censor what people wrote, but rather punish them severely for what they wrote or what they said. And the tool was something called seditious libel, which the law defined incredibly broadly as basically saying almost anything negative about the government, about parliament, about the king. Anything that would likely, I forget the exact language, but incite disaffection among the classes and so on and so forth. And
not
this turned out
say,
to be a pretty
there?
Effective truth. And in fact, you could not claim truth as a defense. Truth made things worse. The idea being that if you said something bad about the king and it wasn't true, well, it wasn't as harmful as if what you said actually was true.
Wow, there's a twist.
And juries didn't get to decide whether you had said anything defamatory. They only got to decide whether you were the publisher. So this was a tool that was used. It was transplanted, of course, into the American colonies. And we enacted a form of it, not quite as austere a form of it, into law, into criminal law in this country in 1798.
Well, how does that square with the First Amendment then?
Very good question. I mean, how is it that 7 years after the Constitution was adopted, after the First Amendment was adopted, some of the same folks could turn right around and impose criminal sanctions for speech that was simply defined as, you know, insulting or bringing into disrepute the president or Congress or the courts or whatever. And I guess nobody quite knows the answer to that. Probably the most widely accepted answer is that it depends on what you mean by freedom of speech and press. And so if you ask yourself, well, what did the framers of the First Amendment mean by that? The answer might well be, well, at the time it meant freedom from censorship, but it didn't mean freedom from punishment after the fact. And so there wasn't really any inconsistency. But nevertheless, the law was controversial at the time. Of course, it was very partisan. It just happened to be that every newspaper editor who was punished under the Sedition Act when it was enacted just happened to be a Jeffersonian Republican and so on. And it expired in 1800, and we didn't have such a thing in 1800 yet as judicial review. Right. Anyway, and so it took until 1964 in this country before the Supreme Court of the United States, in deciding another very important libel case, said in passing, by the way, that 1798 sedition law was certainly unconstitutional.
And we'll get to that 1964 case later, too. I think there was, though there were various forms of sedition laws passed well after 1798. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think Wisconsin was one of a handful of states that passed one. Oh, about 1901 or so.
Yeah, that's right. There was a period in the late 1800s, early 1900s, when many states, including our own, adopted what were called criminal anarchy statutes or criminal syndicalism laws. And in fact, one of these laws, a New York law, was challenged at the level of the U.S. Supreme Court in 1925, and although the court sided with the state of New York and upheld its statute, it did have the secondary and extremely important impact of finally permitting people to challenge state laws, not just federal laws, as essentially violations of the First Amendment. But yes, we've had a long history of this. We've never quite gotten it out of our systems. We had something explicitly called a Sedition Act in the World War I era. It was technically an amendment to the Espionage Act, and it certainly was used to prosecute people. Of course, we had the Smith Act later to address the communist scare in the 1940s and early 50s and so on. So we've never quite gotten this business out of our systems.
Well, looking back at our history, say in the Civil War time with Abraham Lincoln, had someone put in a newspaper a quotation he had not said or put some negative thing, would he have been able to sue for libel?
He might have been able to sue for libel, but what tended to happen if newspapers were aggressively opposing the union policy is that the newspaper might find itself shut down, or an editor might conceivably be taken into custody by the military authorities and so on. And in fact, there's a very, very interesting case coming out of the Civil War. It involved a Southern editor during the Reconstruction period, who was essentially accused by a Union military, a U.S. military commission, sort of shades of today, I suppose, in a way, of having essentially engaged in criticism, inappropriate criticism of the occupying authorities and so on. And he sought a writ of habeas corpus. And after the case had actually been argued by the Supreme Court, Congress passed a law taking the authority of the courts to hear such cases away, which Congress has every right to do. Some people are surprised to hear that, but Congress can adjust the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court of the United States. And the court came down with a decision that said, yes, Congress is right. Sorry, we can't decide this case. Our jurisdiction has been removed. So, you know, these libel kinds of cases, sedition cases, have popped up in quite a variety of very important contexts.
I know there was one case, speaking of Lincoln, in which very critical things were being said of Lincoln and his administration. And generals who happened to be in the neighborhood, well, in New York in this case, actually shut the paper down. And then the administration reversed it and said, mm-hmm. no, that's more dangerous to the administration than what the paper is printing. On the other hand, when there was an editor who printed something that was false and alarming about Lincoln calling up 400,000 additional draftees, that paper was shut down mm-hmm. and the guilty editor arrested. And then it turned out he'd gotten bum information from a reporter at the New York Times who started yeah. it as a hoax. Mm-hmm. So there were some fine lines, I guess, that had to be walked there.
Mm-hmm.
When do we first start seeing what we might think of as these juicy personal libel cases?
Well, that's an interesting question. It's hard to attach a specific date, but certainly you started seeing them in the mid-1850s. And more likely than not, that was a direct outcome of the growth of the so-called penny press and ultimately, of course, the yellow press later in the 1800s and so on. And I suppose that you were getting a kind of coverage in newspapers particularly that you weren't seeing before, and associated with that was probably the growth of libel suits. They were a pesky problem for editors, but perhaps something that they treated as just a cost of doing business, I'm not sure.
Well, we open with that, you know, quotation about Cat Stevens and so mm-hmm. on, which kind of raises the question of the freedom of the tabloids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because anytime you're at the grocery store and you see these incredibly just – you'd hate to find your face and life on the cover of one of those things. They seem to be right. able to get away with all kinds of things. Has that always been the case?
Well, I suppose not. Yes and no. I mean, it all depends on what the material is. I mean, certainly there is a perception out there that the tabloids somehow get away with a lot. In fact, the tabloids have frequently been sued, and sometimes successfully so. The most widely known example probably being Carol Burnett suing the National Enquirer for a piece, maybe it's 20 years ago, something like that now, and winning $500,000, which would in today's dollars be, I don't know, a couple million probably. But in an odd sort of way, I think there are a couple of things that help the tabloids. One is that for the more outrageous kinds of things, they pick on public figures where their protection against libel, the tabloids' protection, is strongest. And the other is precisely because the stuff that they publish, that they make up, is so crazy that no reasonable person would believe it. Well, there's nothing false really being published, and so they're protected by that, which can seem a little odd when in essence, if you try to be responsible, you can end up being liable, but vulnerable. But
that is kind of an odd defense. I mean, how would you even phrase that?
That we're not credible anyway, so
right
how
of,
could you possibly
yes.
sue us?
The right of fantasy or what? I mean, in a courtroom, how would that argument even be articulated?
Oh, well, I've actually seen examples on video and transcripts of where that happened. For example, there was a case a number of years ago in, I want to say Missouri, but I'm not sure, not in Wisconsin anyway, where one of these tabloids had published a story on purportedly a 101-year-old newspaper carrier who had to give up her job now because she'd become pregnant. And they had taken a file photo from somewhere of an old woman and put this on the cover and so on to go with the story. And what they didn't realize was that the person whose picture they used was very much alive, and they found themselves sued for libel and something called false light invasion of privacy. And, you know, they literally put the guy who wrote the story on the stand, and the plaintiff's lawyer, the woman's lawyer, would ask him questions like, how did you go about doing this? And the guy said, well, I just make this stuff all up. And, you
surprise,
know, you
my
make
gosh,
this
I'm
up,
shocked.
Yes, absolutely, out of whole cloth. And And it sounds just devastating. Then they ask him questions about, did you go to journalism school? And did they teach you anything about truth there? And so on. And then the defense lawyer gets a chance, of course. And the defense lawyer's approach, and this is a good example of the way the law of libel works now, is to say, you know, give us some examples of other stories you've written. Well, you know, there was roadkill cannibal, and there was Hitler and Churchill and space aliens and so on. And ultimately building up to the question of, do you think anybody, any reasonable person, would possibly believe any of the things that you write to be true? And, of course, his answer was no. I wouldn't believe that for a moment. And, in fact, that can be critical in a libel case. If the answer to that is regarded as no, nobody would believe it, it doesn't matter how outrageous it is, no liability.
So it sounds like maybe the Onion could get away with quite a few things under that.
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed.
Well, give us an example of a case that was pressed successfully. What were the legs of the argument of the plaintiff, and what was the defense that was attempted?
Okay. Well, I can give you an example of a Supreme Court opinion, for example, a U.S. Supreme Court decision a number of years ago, where, as has not infrequently been the case, we had a libel case come out of a political campaign. It was a campaign for a judgeship, and a newspaper had a source who told it that the challenger had basically offered folks in the courthouse things like free trips to Florida and I forget what else, if they would provide him, the challenger, with some good, you know, political dirt on the incumbent. And the challenger vehemently denied this both before and after the story ran. But nevertheless, it did run with these allegations, and so he brought a libel suit against the newspaper and the reporter. And the evidence showed, for example, that of all of the people who witnessed, and there were witnesses to the conversations in which allegedly this illicit offer was made, every single person denied that any such offer had been made. Every other source said it was false. The challenger was so upset by the allegation that he actually took a lie detector test. The reporter had no interest in listening to it. The newspaper happened to simultaneously be strongly supporting the incumbent editorially. Mm-hmm. There was a tape recording of the interview made with the woman who made the allegations to the reporter, but when you listened to it, it was virtually unintelligible at critical points. And it just went on and on and on, so that circumstantially a strong case was made for the fact that the reporter certainly must have seriously doubted the truth of what was being published. At the very least, it illustrated a conscious effort to avoid finding out what the truth was. And the Supreme Court said that kind of bundling of evidence of all different types, all pointing in the same direction, is enough.
So they don't have to prove malice, or was that also pretty obvious?
They have to prove state of mind. If you're suing a public figure or a public official for libel, if a public official or a public figure is suing you for libel, they must show that either you actually knew you were lying or that you, in fact, must have been having serious doubts as to truth, the truth of what you were publishing, and went ahead and just recklessly published it anyway. Well, how do you get inside somebody's head? And, of course, that's the whole intention of the standard itself, is to make it very difficult for public figures and public officials to win libel suits, but to draw the line at the point where somebody's essentially lying. And so the only way, other than asking a reporter, well, did you really believe what you were publishing? And, you know, not very often would someone say, no, I didn't believe it for an instant, is to build a circumstantial case. And the Supreme Court has made very clear that it has to be a very, very powerful circumstantial case, and that just bits and pieces of evidence, no matter how damning they might seem, are not enough, so that total failure to investigate an allegation, that's not enough to establish the necessary state of mind. Refusing to publish a retraction or accept a vehement denial by somebody, that's not enough. departing radically from standard journalistic procedure, that's not enough in and of itself. You've got to come up with a real package of many, many pieces of evidence that all point in that same direction.
You mentioned that there was a key libel case at the Supreme Court in 1964. We're going to look at that in a moment when we continue with University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Robert Drexel. Our topic for this hour of University of the Air, libel. And now we're set up for this big case that came along in 1964. We've been talking about public figures so far, I think, when these libel cases that we've mentioned. Certainly somebody running for a judgeship would be considered a public figure.
Absolutely.
Is there a difference between public and private figures and what you can say or get away with saying about them?
Yes, there is, and it ultimately is a direct result of this 1964 case that we've mentioned called New York Times versus Sullivan and the developments in the law that it basically set in motion. And if you were, you know, making up a list of the top 10 most important or top 5 most important First Amendment-based cases ever decided by the Supreme Court of the United States, the Sullivan case might well be on that list, if not right at the top, because what it did was really flip the law of libel upside down. It used to be a very plaintiff-friendly legal action. It was really relatively easy for people to win libel suits. Basically, if they could prove that they had been identified and defamed in something that you had published and you didn't have a longstanding common law or statutory defense, for example, you couldn't show that it was true, or you couldn't show that you had obtained it from some official government proceeding, or you couldn't show that it was opinion, then you were pretty much doomed. And the law of libel was called a strict liability tort, which is to say it didn't matter one whit whether the libel had occurred, even though you had been incredibly careful and that it was a virtually unavoidable accident and it would have happened to anybody. It didn't make any difference whatsoever. You were responsible. You did it. You didn't have a defense. You were responsible. And in addition to that, people who won libel suits were entitled to what the law called presumed damages, which is to say that juries were permitted, in the absence of any proof of actual harm to a plaintiff at all, to simply presume that, of course, they must have been damaged and arbitrarily award an amount to compensate the plaintiff. Well, it all changed dramatically in 1964 in this famous libel case brought against the New York Times by a police commissioner in Montgomery, Alabama, who was upset because the Times had published not a news story but an advertisement by a group of civil rights activists which criticized, as well as making a fundraising appeal, criticized the conduct of law enforcement authorities in Alabama, essentially accused them of harassing activists and demonstrators, and particularly the Reverend Martin Luther King. And indeed, the ad did contain some factual mistakes. It had said things that simply weren't true. It had said that at one point, for example, the authorities had surrounded a school campus, that they had padlocked a cafeteria. They made a mistake in the number of times they said Dr. King was arrested and so on. Nowhere in the ad, however, was this police commissioner named. His argument was simply that since the advertisement criticized the police and since he was the police commissioner, well, obviously this constituted a personal libel of him as the police commissioner. And the lawsuit was also brought against at least 4 ministers who also were involved in placing this advertisement. In fact, the Times had just taken the ad. They had made no investigation into the truth of the material in the ad. They had not published a retraction as requested by Police Commissioner Sullivan and so on. And so when the case went to trial, the Times lost once the Alabama courts had concluded that this did indeed identify Mr. Sullivan, which, of course, is a huge stretch in and of itself.
So you mean the New York Times lost in an Alabama court?
It lost in an Alabama court. and it lost to the tune of $500,000. Well, again, multiply that times whatever the inflation factor is. 1964, I suppose that could be, I don't know, $5 million or something like that now. And there were suits pending against the Times in a variety of other jurisdictions, kind of watching to see how this would turn out. And, of course, it was a verdict against these ministers as well. And it seems in retrospect and seemed at the time fairly transparent that this was, in fact, a conscious effort to use the law of libel as a political weapon against civil rights activists and demonstrators and people regarded as troublemakers, including the press itself. The Times only circulated, I don't know, 100 copies of its newspaper in Alabama or something like that at the time. Anyway, there certainly wasn't any national edition of the New York Times. Well, the bind that the Times found itself in was that it had no defense. In essence, it had to admit that it did admit that it had published several things that weren't true, so it couldn't prove the truth of what it had published.
But it was an ad, not a story. Did that matter?
It did not matter, ultimately. And one of the reasons is that's perfectly, by the way, consistent with the law of libel, that you're responsible for everything you publish, whether you've originated it or not. So
same true
nothing unusual there.
Same true for a broadcaster, where it might even be more immediate.
Sure. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is a particular problem for broadcast, actually.
So watch what you say.
Yeah. In any case, they couldn't prove that it was true. It wasn't an opinion. They couldn't say it was that because there were factual mistakes. That wasn't privileged in any way whatsoever. They were doomed. When they appealed ultimately to the U.S. Supreme Court, their argument, a very clever one, was that what you really have here is just what we had in 1798. What you have is a sedition law in disguise. You have a public official who is attempting to manipulate the civil law of libel into what in essence is a prosecution of a newspaper and some civil rights activists for sedition, for criticizing the government in essence. And that argument really was successful, really resonated with the Supreme Court, and led to an extremely important decision that not only reversed this verdict against the New York Times, but set out an entirely new set of standards for the law of libel when public officials are concerned. Flipped everything upside down. No longer did a defendant sued by a public official have to prove the truth of what the criticism was. Rather, the public official could not win without having himself or herself proving the allegation to be false, and not just false, but, as we've already discussed, knowingly false or recklessly false.
Or maliciously?
Well, interestingly enough, malice isn't enough. In that when we talk about malice, most of us think about, you know, ill will, vengefulness, meanness, you know, malice in that sense. And one of the things this court decision did was to say, we're not going to consider that relevant to the law of libel anymore. All that we're going to consider relevant is the state of mind of the defendant relative to the truth of what was published. So that what matters is whether or not you believed what you published was true, not whether you hated the plaintiff's guts.
So the New York Times then only had to prove that it – what? I mean, in the case of Sullivan and publishing this ad that made him his police department not look so good.
It didn't really have to prove anything. I mean, it was certainly free to and did explain how this material came to be published. But what the Supreme Court said essentially was here from here on out, public officials – you're going to have to prove everything. You're going to have to prove there was defamation. You are going to have to prove you were identified. You are going to have to prove it was published. You're going to have to prove it was false. And you are going to have to prove that whoever you're suing knew they were publishing something false. And not only that, but you're going to have to do it with some really powerful evidence. You know, mere preponderance of the evidence, as the law says, you know, a 51-49 split, that's not going to be good enough anymore. You're going to have to provide even more powerful evidence. And this business of malice, as you described it, Norman, was one that so dominated the law of libel up to this point. And suddenly the Supreme Court is saying, oh, that's not relevant anymore. In fact, you could almost see it just the opposite. You know, the very reason I believed this allegation was because I really hated this person. You
right.
know, that's just what I would have expected of somebody like this.
Well, all right. How about this then? How do they define in New York Times versus Sullivan or anywhere else who qualifies as a public figure?
Public. Well, first of all, they had to wrestle with who's a public official. It wasn't too big a problem with somebody who's an elected police commissioner. So, you know, it's easy enough to say, well, any elected official would be a public official. But what do you do? You know, there are a lot of high-ranking officials who are not elected. And how low, you know, how far down in the ranks do you go with public official status? And there were subsequent cases, of course, that wrestled with exactly that question. And ultimately, the Supreme Court has settled on a definition that says that anyone who has or appears to the public to have substantial responsibility for the conduct of public affairs, that person is a public official. Well, that's still a little less than clear, right?
Yes.
But the case in which they said this was one in which they found that a man who was the supervisor of a county-operated ski hill was a public official for purposes of an opinion column that had criticized him. So it suggests that they're willing to go pretty low in the hierarchy. Of course, a case like this is going to set in motion a whole bunch of other cases as people immediately look for clarification or expansion or whatever. And so then the next question, of course, became, well, why confine this to public officials? You know, there are a lot of people in this country who are not public officials but are a heck of a lot more prominent and in many instances a heck of a lot more powerful.
Welcome to Hollywood.
And so indeed it didn't take long before the Supreme Court agreed that it was appropriate to make people who are public figures but not necessarily public officials meet these same high standards of proof in order to win their cases. And of course, once they took that move, though, there's a little bit of a logical inconsistency. Remember, in the Sullivan case, they constructed this new structure on a foundation that had to do with sedition.
Yes,
and they're
dislike
for that. Well, what does Jay Leno have to do with sedition, for example?
Well, how did Carol Burnett win her suit?
Well, she was able to prove actual malice. That is to say, she was able to prove that the inquirer either knew or was reckless and seriously doubted what it published about her was true. Whether that was the result of sympathetic juries in a case like that, I don't know. It's always seemed like a stretch to me, but in any event, she was able to meet that standard of proof somehow. And she had conceded that she was a public figure, so she didn't even argue that question. But the stickiest questions now are, well, who's public and who's not? And that's a really important question these days because if you're not a public figure, then it's easier for you to win a libel suit. There's still a First Amendment barrier that will face you, but you don't have to get inside the defendant's mind and show that the defendant lied. You merely have to show that the defendant was negligent.
Do I have to show damage? Let's say my neighbor publishes something in the paper that says something terrible about what I do at home. Do I have to not only prove it false, but do I have to show that it caused damage? Or again, I mean, did the Sullivan case make any difference in terms of what you have to show as damage?
The Sullivan case itself did not. And in fact, interestingly enough, still today, if a plaintiff can prove this state of mind, lying, knowledge of falsity business, they can have punitive damages, they can have compensation, they can have presumed damages, which you mentioned earlier, I believe. They can get anything, which makes sense, I suppose, if, you know, given the level of blameworthiness that you could attach to that. But the Supreme Court did not for a number of years, for at least 10 years after the Sullivan decision, did not make clear what would be this case for private individuals. And ultimately, what it concluded was that if you're a private person, not a public figure, you have to still prove that what was published was false, that you have to do. But you also are going to have to prove somehow that you were actually harmed, at least psychologically or emotionally or something like that. And you're going to have to at least prove that the person who libeled you acted negligently, which is to say, acted in a way that a reasonable person putting together this material would not have acted, which opens the door to juries then to completely second-guess the conduct of a defendant.
Which could be tricky, I suppose, if you're talking about a fairly specialized situation. And if the jury doesn't know that much about how you publish a paper or something
else. In fact, that may be irrelevant because the standard, and this is in fact the standard in Wisconsin, is the standard of the reasonable layperson. Not the reasonable journalist, you know, not the reasonable talk show host or whatever, but the reasonable person. So they can substitute, in essence, their own judgment.
Now, corporations are considered legally individuals in many ways, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if I say something really malicious and untrue that affects the sales figures or seems to affect the sales figures of Cromwell Tires, they can actually sue me for a libel.
Oh, yes. Businesses, corporations represent a huge portion of libel plaintiffs. So indeed, it is possible to libel a business, libel a corporation, and the rules are essentially exactly the same. If you libel the Cromwell Tire Company, then undoubtedly they will have – they sue you. They will have to prove that what you said was false. But then the courts will have to sort out whether or not the Cromwell Tire folks, that company, is a public figure or a private figure.
That's interesting, but almost by definition. And wouldn't a corporation be a public figure, certainly if they do any advertising, for example?
Well, it's – you know, I mean it's there's a famous quote from a – I can't remember if it was a trial judge or an appeals judge wrestling with one of these public figure, private figure cases set in which he wrote – this is sort of like trying to nail a jellyfish to the wall. And it, you know, it's a very difficult call. You know, if we're talking about General Motors or IBM or something like that, the courts may well simply say they're all-purpose public figures. When you get down to the tavern on the corner down the street, you know, not so clear. And so it can depend. I mean, it'll depend on – thing may depend on advertising. It may depend on the impact that the establishment has on people. It may very well depend, especially for smaller, less visible businesses, on the context in which you are libeling them. And by that I mean, have they done something to involve themselves in some local controversy? You know, have they been, say, lobbying the state legislature for some sort of special legislation pertaining to tavern owners' liability whatever, something, and then you libel them in connection with that. And then the courts may find them to be a public figure on the grounds that they have voluntarily injected themselves into a public controversy trying to influence its outcome.
And you'd also, if I understand you right, be able to protect yourself from a libel case by using the phrase, in my opinion. In other words, if Norman said, in my opinion, Cromwell Tires are bad, that's different than saying Cromwell Tires and then uttering it as if a truth.
There would be no magic in saying, in my opinion.
But I thought opinion was protected.
The question is still going to be, is this really an opinion? And that's as much of a can of worms sometimes as the business of who's public and who's private. I mean, it's not unusual to see cases where a trial judge will look at something that's published and say, oh, it's obviously an opinion. And then there will be an appeal, and then the intermediate appeals court will say, no, that was a factual statement, libel suit reinstated. And then a state Supreme Court will hear the appeal of that and say, no, it was really an opinion. And so what will be looked at very carefully is not whether you try to convince the world that it's an opinion by saying it is, but rather the question is always, how are people going to take it?
Well, it depends a little on who you are too, doesn't it? I remember there's a 1939 case involving Al Jolson on the radio.
Oh, yeah.
And they're talking, somebody mentions the Summit Hotel, and he's, oh, yeah, that's a rotten hotel.
Yeah, yeah, right.
His opinion, but he is a public figure with some charisma of authority.
Right.
And that was an interesting case for a couple of reasons, though, again, because of the broadcasting that we mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And how did that actually play out in terms of the radio station or network?
Yeah, I think the question, I'm struggling to remember the details there, but the question was whether they could be held responsible for something that was essentially beyond their control.
Yes, something spontaneous.
It was ad-libbed. Broadcast.
Yeah. It was ad-libbed. It wasn't in the script. It just blurts it out. And I think under the law at the time, you know, it was a perfectly plausible thing for a court to say he could – that NBC or whoever it was could be held responsible, but they didn't. You know, they were much more practical and realistic about it under those circumstances and said that the network could not be held responsible under those circumstances, and certainly that would be the – I suspect that would be the case today, but – nevertheless, I mean, today it would all play out differently. The question would be, is the hotel a public figure?
Right.
You know, and if it is, did Jolson know? And then, of course, the real question would be, what does that mean anyway? This is a rotten hotel.
Now you're starting to sound like the Clinton administration. What do you mean by rotten?
Exactly. Which to me sounds a lot like opinion.
Well, speaking of the spontaneous and the slightly out of control, let's look at the effect that the internet has had on libel when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
Newspapermen learned to call a murderer an alleged murderer and the King of England the alleged King of England to avoid libel suits. That's a quotation by Canadian humorist Stephen Leacock. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Robert Drexel, and we're talking about libel. Before we get into some recent things having to do with internet cases, I guess I would ask you, what sort of ridiculous things do you now find companies or individuals doing to avoid libel suits, to sort of protect themselves, sort of like in that quote with the alleged King of England?
Yeah, I don't know. That's an interesting question. I don't know that I see people doing much of anything to really protect themselves. And I think that that's exactly how a suit occurs, because people haven't been thinking clearly before they've done something. But, you know, the law of libel these days is so protective of defendants that, you know, you really have to do something pretty screwy to get yourself in serious trouble. That's not to say that, you couldn't be sued unsuccessfully and still end up having it be an extremely expensive and emotionally draining process. But I think, you know, the example that you gave is one that reflects a lot of misconception. And we talked about it a bit before in that there's no magic in saying, in my opinion.
Right.
And it's also the fact that there's no magic in saying alleged, although there seems to be a widespread belief that there is magic in saying alleged. But certainly it's a good idea to say that, but there's no magic in it, like I say. The real reason that you have protection usually when you're talking about an alleged murderer is because there's this thing that's existed for a long, long time, long before the First Amendment was ever involved, called a qualified privilege or a fair report privilege, which permits us to repeat things that have been said during official government proceedings of all types. And courts, of course, are one example. So in any given day, you can pick up a newspaper or turn on television news or listen to the radio, and you can hear incredibly defamatory things, just horribly defamatory things. We just take for granted that we can do that without thinking about the reason. But the reason is, by golly, there's a base of common law and statutory privilege out there that lets us do it. And it has nothing to do with any inherent magic in alleged or, in my opinion, or those kinds of things.
What about the "or I approve this message" line?
Yeah.
Because I was wondering about political campaigns.
Yes. Well, political candidates, of course, are indeed liable for any libels that they themselves commit, although the courts have tended to be pretty generous during political campaigns because, you know, again, it gets back to how will people take what's being said. And we expect a lot of heated rhetoric and perhaps wild allegations in any political campaign, and better to let the candidates settle that in the campaign itself than with lawsuits, but lawsuits do happen. For example, in Wisconsin a number of years ago, we had an incumbent senator, Bob Casten, and he was opposed by Ed Garvey for the Senate seat. And right before the election, the polls apparently were showing a very, very close race. And there were some ads that the Casten campaign ran that said something on the order of, when Ed Garvey was head of the NFL Players Union, X million dollars disappeared, and no one knows where it went. And in fact, Ed Garvey lost that election by a whisker, and some people think it may have been because of the ad. And he did sue Casten, as I recall, and the suit was later settled and with some kind of mutual statements or something like that. But in fact, political candidates can and sometimes have been sued. The interesting question, an interesting question is, what about the broadcasters who run those advertisements?
Who have to run them in some cases.
Right. There's this thing called the Equal Time Law. And that says, essentially, you know, if you're a broadcaster and you permit one legally qualified candidate to use your airwaves, you have to make a similar opportunity available to any other candidate who comes and asks for it. And when you do that, you cannot censor what that candidate says. And so if you're putting on putting Bob Casten on as a legally qualified candidate and he libels somebody, you have to just stand aside and let it happen, you know? And the question is, can you be sued? Under the usual, you know, norms of libel law, you could be.
Because, well, the New York Times was sued for
exactly.
New York Times versus Sullivan.
And it took a decision again by the U.S. Supreme Court involving something that seems to have a nasty name these days, interpretation of a statute, namely the Equal Time Law. The Supreme Court was asked by a broadcaster who had indeed been sued under just those circumstances. The court was asked to interpret the Equal Time Law as inherently granting broadcasters absolute immunity from legal responsibility when they are in a situation where they have to put a candidate on and the law explicitly forbids them from censoring what the candidate says.
Sounds fair.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was wondering then about spreading rumors about a candidate over the internet. What's fair game and what's not?
Well, I don't know if there's a clear answer to that. I mean, the internet is something in which the rules of the game are both unchanged in the overall law of libel and yet still evolving because of some particularly unusual circumstances that are inherent in the technology, I guess, of the internet. So the basic rules, you know, that there has to be defamation and publication and identification and this public-private distinction made and proof of falsity and all that. That's all the same in an internet environment. But
except, of course, if the guy is in Nigeria, there's not a lot you can do about it.
Precisely, and that's one of the difficult things. Or if the person is anonymous, what if you don't know who the person is? Under what circumstances can you find out who that person is? And what about the internet service providers? Are they responsible in the same way that a newspaper is responsible for everything it publishes?
They say not when you,
right.
Read the fine print.
Yes, uh-huh. Yes. And they're right because Congress, maybe 12, 13 years ago, something like this, when it passed a major telecommunications bill, included something called the Communications Decency Act. The guts of which was found unconstitutional, actually. That is the part of it that actually attempted to regulate indecent material on the internet. But another part of the CDA essentially gave internet service providers complete immunity from libel, invasion of privacy, and so on for material that their systems were used to disseminate. In other words, they would not be treated as publishers in the same way a newspaper publisher would be treated. And they had lobbied for that for the understandable reason that anything else would open us to total endless liability and we'd be out of business and there'd be no internet access for anybody. And One of the interesting questions, though, is what is exactly an Internet service provider? And there's a strong indication so far that the courts are interpreting the CDA to mean that, for example, if the State Journal website makes itself open to readers posting comments and so on and so forth, that if a reader posts a libelous comment, that the State Journal will not be responsible for that. It would be if it were in a letter to the editor on the printed page.
Right.
But not necessarily in the Internet
environment. And what's the distinction? Does it have to do with choice in some way?
Well, it just has to do with the reach of this statute and, again, the question of whether the State Journal, when it's functioning as the operator of a website, is within the reach of this statutory immunity. And it would appear that it would be. Not for stuff that it produces itself, but for things produced by third parties
right.
out there. And I suppose the rationale would be similar, and that is that again, if you had to worry about that liability, given how many postings there are and whatnot, why, you might well just shut down that whole part of your operation.
One of the areas where there have been quite a few recent cases, it seems to me, is in the criminal field where somebody might be accused of or held up as a person of interest, as with the anthrax case,
mm-hmm,
or
mm-hmm.
sort of damned for killing their daughter, or, you know, where even long after the case has ended, the person still remains under a cloud of suspicion.
Yes.
What have you been watching lately that sort of is interesting from a standpoint of libel?
Oh, probably that you mentioned it already, probably the Hatfield case, which involves the anthrax poisonings, and a libel suit brought against the New York Times by this guy, Stephen, I believe it is, Hatfield, who was identified by the Times in a column, was identified as a person of interest in the anthrax poisoning investigation. And his claim was, and I don't think it was an unreasonable claim, that these columns essentially were identifying him as the most likely person to have been the anthrax poisoner. And the information the Times was using essentially had come to it from unidentified sources within the government. And it was an interesting case in a variety of ways. One being, is this man a public figure or not? The courts ultimately concluded that he was, and that's why the Times won its libel suit, because he couldn't show the necessary state of mind, knowledge of falsity that he needed to show in order to win. But the second related interesting question was, could he subpoena successfully the New York Times journalists who did these pieces and demand that they reveal who the sources were?
Oh, boy, a big can of worms.
A huge can of worms. Whole nother issue.
Yeah.
Big issue these days.
Makes you wonder a little bit, too, in a case like that, whether you can become a public figure against your will and then mm-hmm. still be more subject to all of these libelous attacks.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, you can become one against your will.
It's a tough world out there. Our guest this hour has been Robert Drexel. And, well, this is so much fun that we'll have to talk some more of these cases as they come up.
Mm-hmm.
Look forward to that occasion. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for our next hour of University of the Air.